Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is it like to live at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue? Much is written about the way presidents conduct their professional lives, making decisions, planning strategy, and responding to crises. They have the country's brightest minds at their disposal and can reach other world leaders within seconds. But at the end of the day, every U.S. president is also a human being who needs to be safely and expeditiously transported from place to place, not to mention the need for food, sleep, exercise, and clean laundry. So what does it take to attend to the president's day-to-day physical needs and to make over the White House so that it fits each first family comfortably? Elizabeth Buemiller is national affairs correspondent for The New York Times. She covered the White House from 2001 until 2007. For the current issue of National Geographic magazine, she has written an article called Inside the Presidency, and she's here now to talk about it. Elizabeth, welcome back to Think.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I have to imagine that the permanent staff of the White House have to be very flexible individuals in order to go from one administration to the next.
That's right, but there are that's certainly the case, and but they're good at it. They change every 4 to 8 years, and many of the people on the permanent staff have been there for decades, and their family members have been there. So it's a job that goes back generations. But the permanent staff is about 90 people. That's in the White House residence, and that includes you know, butlers and maids and cooks and maitre d's, elevator operators, florists, carpenters, electricians, plumbers, all the people that we usually have to call and have come to our houses when there's a problem.
And it's also their job, I guess, to sort of teach each first family what it means to live in the White House.
That's right. That's primarily the job of the chief usher, who he's kind of the guy who runs the household, runs the 90-member staff. He's kind of like a grand hotel manager. The person I interviewed for this article, National Geographic, is Gary Walters, who just retired from the job in the last year or two of the Bush presidency, of this Bush presidency. And but previously he was there for 31 years, and so his job, the chief usher, then usually sits down with the first lady. The incoming first lady, it's always been a first lady. You know, it might have been a first man. Hillary Clinton had won the presidency. It sits down with her and in a very traditional way and says, you know, what kind of snacks does your husband like? What kind of snacks do your children like? If there's children, when do you get up in the morning? What do you want for breakfast? You know, what should we put in the kitchen? You know, who is going to have what bedroom? What are the personal things you like in the bathrooms? I mean, every aspect of life that he can think of, he will ask the first lady, and then she'll, you know, from there they'll go forth.
Which makes perfect sense, because for the next 4 or 8 years, depending on the administration, these people won't stop into CVS or Target to pick up what they need.
Well, they could, but it'll create a traffic jam in Washington and make a lot of people unhappy. So no, that doesn't happen. So the other interesting thing, which was sort of my favorite part of this, which is for anybody who moves, you know, and I've moved a number of times in the last 10 years, and we all know what a headache it is. In this situation, you know, this is my favorite fact, that, you know, on January 20th, the outgoing president, George Bush, will leave the White House at 10 a.m. to go up to the Capitol for Barack Obama's inaugural address. And at that moment, at 10 a.m., the Obama's moving van will arrive in the White House driveway and start unloading, and the staff then has about 6 hours to unpack the small amount of furniture usually that a president brings to the White House, plus all the personal belongings, clothes, knickknacks, photographs, and so forth. And so by 4 p.m., the president and his family are to have, you know, all their clothes put away in drawers, their personal pictures hung, their favorite snacks in the kitchen. Can you imagine what a luxury that would be?
I definitely got the sense that Walters was happy to be retiring before going through
right.
another one of these.
Right. He said that was his worst possible day, and they actually, in those 6 hours, my 90-member staff, they're all deployed to do this so quickly. And they go through various verbal dry runs, so everybody knows what they're supposed to be doing on that day. So, but the bottom line is that Barack Obama and Michelle Obama and their children are, if all goes as planned, will walk in on January 20th after the inaugural parade and all will be in place in their new home.
How big are the private living quarters? How many square feet do they have available to them and only them?
Well, that's a good question. I don't actually know the answer to that, how many square feet. And I actually have never been upstairs at the White House in the private part of the residence. But I can tell you, it's not considered large. I mean, most of us would be considered quite large, but on the scale of, you know, European palaces, Buckingham Palace, you know, the palaces of kings and queens of royalty in Europe, in Asia as well, it's quite modest. Again, not to the rest of us, but it's not large, and it really is. You get a sense too when I covered the White House and I was, you know, on the state floor a lot. I mean, again, it's big, but it's not something that Queen Elizabeth would find large. And they have a couple of floors, but it's not a vast amount of space. And Laura Bush has always said, and other people have said as well, that it's a lot like living above the shop. Because I remember once coming back from a trip I was covering with Laura Bush's, and we drove. I was in the press van behind her limousine, and we dropped her off at the South Portico, the entrance and sort of the back of the White House, if you want to, the South entrance, you know, the South Lawn entrance where the family comes and goes. And it was 8 o'clock at night. It was in the winter, and I was struck by how everything was bustling around her. You could still see the lights on in the West Wing. Most of the staff members were still at work. It was 8 o'clock. There were a lot of lights on upstairs. There was a lot of staff and Secret Service around, and she bustled into what was effectively the front door of her residence, and it was just so busy, you know. And I had a sense that, you know, it really isn't. I mean, it's a lovely place, but it's not quiet. And so I had a sense she is living above the shop.
And what sense do you have of how private it is for them? I know that they don't necessarily always have Secret Service in the room with them, but how much would the staff know about their personal business?
Well, there's an interesting story. You know, I haven't been up there with them, right? So I can't tell you what the answer to that question is. But they do have privacy up there. I mean, the Secret Service is not in the rooms with them, as you say. And I remember early in the first administration when President Bush choked on a pretzel. Remember, he was watching a football game on a Sunday with the dog Barney.
Right. And there's nobody else in the room.
Nobody else is in the room. He choked. He coughed. He blacked out. He hit his head on a table or something going down, and nobody was there to see it. And so when I did a story on it afterward, the president doesn't have a baby monitor on him, you know, so it is possible that he could have been left alone for some time in that room.
Elizabeth Buemiller is my guest. She's national affairs correspondent for The New York Times and has just published a piece in the current National Geographic magazine called Inside the Presidency. I think my favorite detail had to do with the food. I had no idea that the first family is billed for all of the food that they themselves eat if there's not a state function going on.
Right. And as I remember very well from, I mean, this goes back to my first time in Washington, but, you know, Rosalynn Carter, Jimmy Carter's wife, was, when she was first lady, was shocked when she got the first bills for the food and also billed for dry cleaning and personal things like that. And and Gary Walters, the White House usher who runs the household, said that every first family has complained about the bills because it is, you know, you're dealing with chefs who are making, you know, they're buying the finest ingredients, they're making, you know, even if it's simple stuff, they're buying the best chicken, you know, whatever, the best fish, and so it adds up. And I don't know if the number is available, even if the average amount of money the first family would spend on food every week, but bear in mind too that you can obviously, if you have members of Congress in, or you know, or diplomats or ambassadors or visiting foreign dignitaries. I mean, those will be billed to the taxpayers, or if it's a political function, to the Republican or Democratic National Committees. But if you have your friends in, you pay.
Is there any limitation at all on when and how they can entertain at the White House?
That's a good question. Not that I know of. I think the limitations are only their own. You know, how many parties they can stand to have and go to, and in a week. You know, during the Christmas season, I know that. This President Bush and Laura Bush would give, I think I once wrote a number that the president shook 7,000 hands at Christmas, during Christmas parties. He would have like 14 to 20 Christmas parties every December. So, and those were often official. You know, you'd have, the diplomatic corps in, you'd have Congress in, you'd have the Supreme Court in. It was just part of the sort of standard official entertaining at the White House. The Clintons gave enormous parties. I didn't cover the Clinton administration. I was in New York in those years. But they gave huge parties that you can see documented. I've heard about, certainly, you can see them documented in one of the a book that Hillary, a couple books that, no, there's one book that Hillary Clinton, a big coffee table book called Entertaining at the White House. And you look at enormous parties. They put a tent on the South Lawn for one New Year's Eve party, as I recall.
Do you get the sense that people are actually enjoying themselves at these parties, not just with the Clintons, but with the Bushes or the other Bushes or anybody? Or is everyone so much on their best behavior, including the first family, that these are just sort of command performances?
Well, it depends on what kind of a party you're talking about. You know, the parties I've been to are the ones like on the state floor, these sort of giant things. You know, I haven't been to anything intimate upstairs. But I'm sure there's a difference. On the state floor, you have the state dining room, and then there's the east room on the other end, and then there's in between the red room and the green room and other rooms. And then there's the grand foyer, the great hallway, people generally seem to be happy to be there. I mean, this is a huge generalization, but a lot of times it doesn't really matter who is president, that the entertaining, there is a certain sameness to the entertaining, you know, in terms of the standard, the permanent staff. So a lot of times people bring cameras and they take pictures, certainly at the White House Christmas parties. The White House looks very beautiful no matter who is president. You know, it's always exquisite, and people come with their cameras and they look at the beautiful food and the decoration. So even though there's hundreds of people there, people, mostly I've observed, people are very happy to be there, just to be at the White House. Obviously upstairs it's more intimate, when the president has just some friends over, you know. And well, it'll be very interesting to see how the Obamas change entertaining. The Bushes have not been big partiers. You know, they did not go out a lot in Washington. President was a very early to bed kind of a guy, didn't drink. And so we'll see how different the Obamas are. There's some indications they'll be somewhat more sociable.
Well, it's interesting, even, you know, having young children, the dynamic there will be really different. I guess the girls will want to have their friends over. Do you know anything about the clearance that's required before a personal friend can come into the White House?
I'm sure there's some, but all presidential children have had friends over. You know, Chelsea Clinton had her friends over, actually from Sidwell Friends, where the Obama children are now going. So, yeah, I'm sure there's standard clearance where you give your Social Security number and your birthday. That's true for any visitor at the White House. And there's a very basic system that's set up, and they, you know, so, but the, you know, it's obviously, it's done. It's been done for decades. And so I think Gerald Ford's daughter, Susan Ford, had her, I believe it was her prom or one of her, was it her prom or her junior dance at the White House. So people do, kids do entertain there.
Elizabeth Buemiller is my guest. She's national affairs correspondent for the New York Times and covered the White House from 2001 to 2007. Her article in the current National Geographic magazine is called Inside the Presidency. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Coming up, we'll talk about how the president travels.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is New York Times National Affairs correspondent Elizabeth Buemiller. She has written a piece for the current issue of National Geographic called Inside the Presidency. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. I can't even imagine what's required to coordinate a major trip or even a minor one. Just leaving the White House is a big deal.
That's right. And but when the biggest presidential trips are those overseas, and that just this is like this enormous traveling caravan. One of my favorite facts from those trips is that it requires 600 to 800 hotel rooms at each stop to house the president and his traveling entourage, which includes up to 800 people. Among those are usually this is again the Well, this is true for almost any president. 30 White House staff members, more than 100 members of the Secret Service, and when it's a big story, about 150 representatives of the media, television or radio correspondents, camera crews, sound technicians, newspaper reporters, wire service reporters, still photographers. Now, in the last days of the Bush administration, those numbers were greatly reduced as as the story became less important and people were focusing on the president-elect. But I am certain that on the first foreign trip of this incoming president, there will be an enormous caravan.
And I had no idea that the Times, for example, had to pay your way if you were flying there on Air Force One.
Well, sure, and on the press charter as well. Yeah, otherwise you're taking a favor from the White House. So it's extremely expensive to travel with the president, cover the president, which is one reason you see a lot of drop off at the close of administration. It's astronomical. But by the way, it is also this is not part of the story, but it's also very expensive to travel with presidential candidates. I covered John McCain in this 2008 campaign, and that's also expensive. You get billed for, not only just the plane fare, which is typically first class plus, often way beyond first class, as well as, seats on the bus. It's true of the White House, seats on the bus, anything you eat in the press filing centers, the Wi-Fi, the communications, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, even if you didn't have time to eat breakfast, it gets very expensive.
And how are decisions made about who is on, for example, Air Force One and who goes in the accompanying plane?
Among the press or just among staff? Or?
First among the media, and then we can talk about staff as well.
Okay. Well, the media in the back of Air Force One, which is a 747 with woofers and tweeters and very reconfigured 747. There are 14 seats for the press. There always have been, and there's a rotating way you go in and out. In every one of those 14 seats, there's one seat for a newspaper reporter. So there is a rotating pool that goes in and out of that seat among the newspaper reporters who regularly cover the president. Typically, there's one seat for a magazine reporter. There are seats for the Associated Press reporter, for the Bloomberg reporter, et cetera, for all the wire services. There is a seat for a television correspondent and a camera crew. There is one seat for a still photographer. You basically have one seat representing each kind of medium provides news of the presidency. And then there's a very set schedule of whose turn it is to have pool duty. And sometimes if you're a reporter, you want to have that Air Force One seat. Sometimes it's not quite as desirable depending on where you are in a trip. It's a trade-off because if you're the pool reporter, you're responsible for, as your newspaper reporter, writing the pool report when you land or sometimes, and that can be a very big responsibility sometimes. Sometimes it's not. But you have to file that pool report to your fellow correspondents saying, hey, everybody, this is what happened on Air Force One. The press secretary said this, the president sometimes, not so much with this outgoing president, but maybe more with a new one, said this, et cetera, et cetera, and when he landed, he was greeted by so-and-so. Here's the conversation that happened. You know, you have to file that before you file your own story.
Yeah, and is it always an advantage to be there, or are there times when the staff and the president really don't make much of an appearance at all to the media members that might be there, and you just sit there and pay a lot of money to be on that plane?
Right, although you pay a lot of money to be on the White House press charter, too. I mean, it's kind of there's not that huge amount of difference. It depends on the flight. Sure, sometimes there's a great advantage to be there because you see something up close that you wouldn't see otherwise. You know, if there's a tour of something really interesting. I mean, I was on the Air Force One flight that went to Ground Zero on September 14th, 2001. That was a very good, important flight to be on, you know. But I had a monster pool report to file, and I had very difficult time with communications in New York that day, as you can imagine. Other times when you're coming back from a trip overseas and you're exhausted, you've been traveling for 7 days, you've had very little sleep each day, and the last thing you want to do is go on Air Force One and have them, because you can't sleep because they come back and they, I mean, I shouldn't be saying this, but sometimes they come back. In the Bush administration, they would come back and they would tell you why the trip was such a great success, right? Even though you'd written everything you were going to write, and that's their view of the trip was a great success. It didn't mean you wanted to write that, or that was the fact. You know, there'd be a lot of spinning going on, and there wasn't. You know, and so that was. You didn't necessarily want that trip, but we all would take them. And other times, true. You would never see the president. There would be very little coming out of the press secretary, and yet you were on Air Force One and, you know, with the responsibility to write a pool report when it was an extremely inconvenient time. So, but I guess I should not be so cynical here and say that, you know, obviously it's a very interesting, challenging, rewarding job to cover, you know, the president, any president.
So we all know that there are quarters for the president on the plane. He has a place to sort of stretch out and sleep if he wants to. Can you talk about what you know of his personal space on the plane?
Well, I've never been up there, actually, because I can tell you what it's. I've seen pictures of it and certainly seen movies of it. But this President Bush had reporters up to the front of the plane very little, and he certainly didn't have them into his bedroom. But he has up in the nose of the plane. There are two sleeping cots or beds that are sort of built into the sides of the nose where the president can nap. And there's a shower up there, and it's quite nice, you know. And it's quite he's got a big conference room up there, he's got an office he can work in. Bush, when he was still able to run, would take a treadmill on the plane sometimes and just exercise on the way over to a trip or on the way back. So it's quite nice. For the press, it's like the first class section of a regular plane, of a United plane or something.
Are you eating the same food the president's eating?
Yeah, they say we are. They always said we were. It's nothing especially fancy. It's kind of good. Basic American food. It's nothing elegant or anything, but it's very nice. It's done. You know, you'd have hamburgers and stuff like that. You can get a peanut butter and jelly sandwich if you want. Again, we pay for that as well.
And all the wine served in conjunction with any kind of presidential event is always domestic wine.
Since the Ford administration. The White House stopped serving French wine in the Ford administration. So, you know, now with, of course, you know, my God, with California wine and, you know, Virginia wine and New York, all these different states now, that's now the standard. One of my favorite facts about this is that, you know, there used to be in the old days, during the Francophile old days, that, you know, the White House listed the menus were in French of all things, and that changed as well. But I love this that Amy Eisenhower once had her favorite apple brown Betty listed on the menu as Betty Brune de Pomme. So those days are over.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Elizabeth Buemiller is my guest. Her article in the new National Geographic is called Inside the Presidency. So the president doesn't just take Air Force One. He's got his own limousine in the belly of another plane that comes along, and sometimes two limousines.
That's right. There's always two. One is a limo, and one is a spare. Sometimes it's called the decoy because you don't know which one the president. You can't tell which one the president is in. But sometimes they've needed the spare because if one of them blows a tire or something, and they whisk the president to that one. And the limo is called the Beast. It's heavily fortified. It's able to withstand all sorts of terrorist attacks. It's very, very quiet. I've never been inside the limo, but people who have tell me that it's absolutely silent inside because of all this stuff in it. So it's the president, you talk about the bubble. There is a bubble. I mean, the president, when he travels in the limousine, can see out, but he can hear almost nothing.
And so he's in this sort of tricked out vehicle, and you said it weighs 10,000 pounds in the piece?
Is that what I said? I'm sure. Yeah. That sounds right. I've seen up close, and it's an enormous, heavy, very heavy duty car. Again, it's impregnable, I would say, and looks very nice inside.
I heard just today that GM is selling off a lot of old things that they've had in their warehouse, one of which was a replica of the presidential limousine from 86 that was used in a movie. Do you know how often they change the vehicle? Is it something that, are they driving around in a 15-year-old Cadillac?
That is a good question. I think the president is using now is relatively new. I don't know. Again, I don't know what kind of servicing goes into it or, again, how often they change it, but this one I think is fairly new, a couple years old. It's got a V8 engine, I know that, and again, it's very nice.
Does the president and the first lady have to pack their own things, or is there sort of always a case ready to go?
That's a good question. I suspect I don't actually know the answer to that. I didn't ask Gary Walters that. I bet they have maids, they have LAs. I bet they have help. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's probably individual, but wouldn't that be nice if you didn't have to pack?
It'd be great. It would change travel completely. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the president's valet and sort of what he does. He's got a right-hand man, a special assistant.
Right, and he takes care of the president's clothes. He sees that, he doesn't pick out the president's clothes. I mean, you sort of imagine, from movies that, or, the Prince of Wales or something, somebody lays out his clothes for him. This guy, he's more there to keep his shoes shined, to deal with the seamstress if there's a button missing or if there's a tear, to send out the shirts, just to keep track of it all. And he doesn't pick out the ties, Gary Walters says the president selects his own suit from the closet each day. This is not royalty we're talking about here.
And these trips, when there's a major international trip, it would seem that the staff would all want to go. But I think you wrote in there, this is not for the faint of heart. These things are tough on the staff.
Right. Of course, I think, but I do think the staff does like to go. I mean, I do think, sure, there's endless amounts of work. There's very little sleep. If you're in a different city in a different country every day, and you're moving around with this caravan, and you've got to set up an office every place you go. They're very, very tough trips, but there's also a lot of excitement in them. You're going to places many people have never seen before. You've never been before, and you're seeing foreign leaders, and it's all very exciting. Often big news is happening, and so sure, the staff likes to go, and it's just a sign of status that you're one of the best among the staff because you're going. At the same time, I have to tell you that people who are left behind often work twice as hard. I remember that from I would trade off trips I had two other colleagues on the White House beat with me at the Times, and we would trade off trips. So when I would stay back, I would go over to the White House and it seemed very quiet, and you'd go over to the press office and they would say, oh, I've been up since 4 this morning because, I'm getting requests from the road, from India or from Pakistan or from China, wherever the president was, having to handle a lot of they would have to be manning the office back in Washington. They'd be very busy, and then there would always be like an acting chief of staff, because the chief of staff would be traveling, and that person would be, again, inundated with requests from and problems from Congress, from everything that goes on when the president's there. But it was a small skeleton crew. They were saying it was always a lot of hard work.
And how did it work for you when you were sort of tag teaming with these other two reporters? Because we imagine you'd need to have it be like Village of the Damned, where one person on the team knows something and then all three of you know it. But I wonder how often you met physically, or was this something that read each other's work?
Oh, the three of us, the three Times reporters who covered the White. Sure, we all worked in the same office. We're all still here. we all have different jobs now. But it was David Sanger, myself, and Richard Stevenson, and we all work in the New York Times Washington Bureau, which is, in downtown Washington, just a few blocks from the White House. We also have a cubicle in the White House press room over at the White House in the press briefing room. We didn't use it too often because there's no privacy over there, and you couldn't have a phone conversation without all your competitors knowing about it. So we would go over there, many times during the day it was a short walk for briefings and interviews and events and speeches and so forth. And so we kind of just traded off. There was a lot, the Bush presidency, there was a lot going on, as you probably remember. There was a few wars and a few things going on. So we would trade off on the travel, on domestic trips as well as foreign trips. It was kind of a loose rotation of, the foreign trips were obviously much more desirable than a lot of the domestic trips, which were often just fundraisers where there was very little news. Sometimes they were pretty good, but the foreign trips were the big plums, and so we would just take turns with them.
Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that the press quarters that are in the White House are pretty small. Is that right?
They're very small. They're much nicer now than they were when I actually left the beat in mid 2006. I didn't cover the White House until 2007, they're quite small. I mean, like the White House is small, but they're much nicer now because they were renovated in the last year and a half. So they're clean now and very nice.
Elizabeth Buemiller is my guest. She is national affairs correspondent for the New York Times. She's just published a piece called Inside the Presidency for the January 2009 National Geographic. We'll be back in a minute. If you have a question, you can ask it at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Elizabeth Buemiller is my guest. She's national affairs correspondent for the New York Times. She was covering the White House for years. Her new piece in the January 2009 National Geographic is called Inside the Presidency. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Much has been made about the fact that President-elect Obama is going to have to give up his BlackBerry, which is something that he's never likes to be far away from.
Right.
I was amazed to read in your piece that the White House Communications Agency builds a communication system every time it goes to a different destination.
Right. Yeah. Can you imagine? That's so the president can be. For example, in a foreign city, if the president needs to call somebody back home, he just picks up his phone, and it's like a U.S. phone. I mean, and they've made it so he just, dials the number. Actually, he probably doesn't even dial a number, or, a lot of times his aides do it for him. But if he just wants to call his mother, he can pick up the phone and dial her local number, her number, So, and they do that for security reasons. And, President Bush was a big emailer before he came to the White House during the campaign, in 2000, but he gave it up once he got to the White House because they just think there's just too many ways to hack in, even if it's the White House computer system, and so it's done. I think it does cut you off, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say, it makes perfect sense that they can't email and use cell phones, but emails in particular seem to be the way people correspond in this century.
Yeah, even more so now than 8 years ago when Bush took office. And I mean, he was kind of almost, I don't think he had a BlackBerry. He was kind of pre-BlackBerry. And it does keep you out of things. So Obama will have to get used to that. I guess you'll just have things delivered on paper. But the other thing is, too, I guess as president, there is so much incoming information constantly. I suppose the one thing you could say about it would focus you a little bit more. I mean, email, as we all know, is enormously distracting.
Yeah, it could be liberating suddenly not be allowed to use it.
You don't want the President of the United States sitting there in the Oval Office getting little dings every 15 seconds, you know.
Forwards.
And having to deal with it. So it will maybe focuses your brain more.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Lee in Dallas. Hi, Lee.
Hi, I have a question. You mentioned that the president has to pay for their food, and they get a bill they weren't really expecting. I was curious about their laundry bill, such as their dry cleaning. I know that my employer expects me to look nice every day, and I can't write off my dry cleaning, so does the president get to?
With regard to the
girls' school, is that something that they pay for personally, or are we paying for it? Thank you, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks.
Well, those are good questions. I do know from Gary Walters that, yes, if the president, they do take care of their dry cleaning bills themselves. As for the school, I just don't know the answer to that. My guess is they probably pay for it. I just don't know. They were obviously paying for the girls' private school in Chicago, so my guess is it's the same. But I just don't. I just don't know, frankly.
You mentioned, Elizabeth, that most presidents don't bring very much personal furniture with them into the White House. Do you know what happens to their homes that are sort of shuttered for 4 years?
Well, the Clintons did not have a home. The Bushes had only the ranch. They've just now bought a home in Dallas, the current Bushes. I don't know. I know that the Obamas are keeping their home in Chicago. I'm not covering Obama right now, but I noticed that he said as he was on his way back from Hawaii, he stopped in Chicago and then headed for Washington over this weekend, that he was in the house and it was empty. You know, he said it was very depressing when he stopped into the house because his wife and daughters had come to Washington earlier so they could get ready for school on Monday morning. I just don't know the answer to how much personal furniture the Obamas brought to the White House and how much they put in storage and I just don't know the answers to that.
Yeah, it's just interesting to think about. Yeah. Obviously, that residence will have to be guarded even if they don't set foot in it all this
right,
time.
Right. I can attest it was certainly heavily guarded in Hyde Park when I was there in the fall. It was you couldn't get near it. Streets were blocked off all around it. And right now in Washington, with their president-elect is staying at the Hay Adams, which is just a few blocks from our office here, and it is streets are shut down all over the place.
Do people in D.C. really get irritated by that, or is it such a fact of life that nobody thinks about it anymore?
Mostly people are used to it. It's downtown. I mean, right now it's much more than usual because the Hay Adams is right across Lafayette Park across from the White House, so it's created a bigger perimeter around the White House where you can't drive. But I don't think people are complaining too much. I mean, it's just you have to walk around. It's a short time. When there's foreign dignitaries staying at Blair House, which is the guest house right across the street from the White House, that happens too. You get huge numbers of just a much wider perimeter around the White House that's blocked off. But I have to say that during a normal day, I still find it kind of extraordinary that you can actually walk so close to the White House. You can't drive anymore, but you can walk out right outside the White House gates, as any tourist can see.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Sam in Dallas. Hello, Sam.
Hello. Hello, Chris. Great program. And Elizabeth, I enjoy your pieces in the Times. I had a couple questions. What agency hires the domestic staff for the White House, the butlers and the maids and that sort of thing? And my second question was, I know in the past some former domestic staff there at the White House have written memoirs and that sort of thing.
Right.
I think Jacqueline Kennedy perhaps had the staff sign an agreement that they wouldn't write memoirs. And I wondered if Gary Walters was planning on writing a memoir. I'm sure he's seen a lot of history and was wondering if he was planning on writing a memoir. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
These are all good questions, and I just realized I don't know the answers to most of them. I don't know. I wonder if it's the GAO, the government. I don't know who hires the domestic staff at the White House. I know they're government employees. You know, so I just don't know. I know that if you work at the White House, in the West Wing, you're part of the executive office of the president. That's who you work for. And I know that a lot of the people who take care of the grounds of the White House are employees of the National Park Service. I just don't know about that 90-member domestic staff. That's a very good question. I don't know if people have signed promises not to write books. I don't think Gary Walters has a book in him, but I'm not sure about that. I know that the chef who was fired by Laura Bush, my colleague Marion Burroughs wrote about his book. He's written a book.
Yeah, we had him on the show, and we've had the pastry chef.
Know more than I do, right. So I just don't know the answers to those. But those are actually very good questions.
We have an email from Lisa in Denton wanting to know if the First Lady has a hairdresser and makeup artist every day.
Well, yes. But again, I don't know, the name of Laura Bush's, but she obviously, I don't know if it's every day, but certainly when she goes out or has a public event, she's been professionally, made up and her hair has been done. There was a lot more, there's been not very much media attention paid to that under Laura Bush. And I remember Nancy Reagan's hairdresser became a celebrity at the time. So we'll have to see what happens with Michelle Obama. Hillary Clinton had her hair done again when she was at the White House every day.
And I have to imagine the Obamas will pay for their own child care. There's got to be a nanny or someone when both parents are busy.
Well, I think, again, I'm not covering the Obamas, but I think that Mrs. Obama's mother will be around to help out.
Oh, I did hear that. She's moving in with them.
So I don't know if there, again, I don't know if there's a nanny or not. I just don't know that. But sounds like the mother will have a fairly large role.
Yeah, as you mentioned, you haven't been up in the private quarters, but you've certainly been around all this for a long time. I'm wondering what your sense is. People either look at this and think, wow, it sounds grand, or they think, I would never in a million years want anything like that. As someone who covers all this, what's your sense of how good it is to be president?
Oh, well, I think it's interesting. A lot of, from interviews I've had and from over the years, a lot of families have really liked living in the White House. Ronald Reagan complained about it as a terrible fishbowl, and there certainly is. You're right in the middle of town, and the land around it is not that big. And, Laura Bush, I always used to think she can look right out of that I think it's the West Sitting Hall. She can look out of that beautiful, this huge window, and she looks right down on the press office and the West Wing driveway where we're all hanging out. How relaxing is that? Or she could look out some of the bedroom windows and see, what used to be called Pebble Beach, which was the sort of scruffy collection of stones where all the network correspondents and cable, news correspondents used to do their stand-ups, and it was right. It was her, basically her front yard, and so again, that can't be that relaxing. But they've all families. Most families I can remember have said that they grew closer. That marriages grew closer at the White House, the president, first lady, because they saw so much more of each other. The president had a 2-minute commute to walk to the office, and he could go home for lunch if he wanted. And they were just much closer, in much closer quarters, and they saw much more of each other. And Hillary Clinton has talked about how much she loved living in the White House, and she wrote a whole book about it, in fact, and talked about just how moved she was by the sense of history, living among, in this great historical monument, and just the sense of history she always felt. And I have to say, the White House is a beautiful place. It's just beautiful. Again, it's not so big as to be overpowering. It's not a palace. Everything is very nicely taken care of. The gardens are beautiful. The Rose Garden is beautiful. The the state floor that I've seen has been redone a number of times over the last couple of decades, and it's been redone very beautifully by various first ladies, and so a lot of people, I would say most families have liked it very much.
And they do get some kind of decorating budget, right, to come in and make some changes, but it tends to be less than anybody can spend to redo things.
Right. The Reagans were criticized for spending, you know, getting money from their friends to contribute to redo the White House. They came in right after the Carters, and you know, Nancy Reagan was from California, from Los Angeles, and had lots of friends in Hollywood, and was taken aback by how shabby it was, and you know, cast aspersions on the Carters, and, you know, and so it was very criticized. But so what's been done more recently has been done quietly. There, again, I know more about the state floor, which is paid for by government funds. But, again, there's very strict requirements for what you can actually do down there. It has to be historically, you know, correct.
Do you have a sense of ownership about the White House yourself, having worked there?
Do I think like it's my house because I'm a citizen?
No, having had at least an office there and space there.
No, I don't feel that way at all. I feel like I'm just I liked working there. I liked walking in the mornings, you know, on the West Wing Drive. I liked walking in that drive. It's very pretty, and I liked it when the president had a press conference in the Rose Garden, because it was always pretty, whether it was the fall or the summer or the spring. I liked the decorations at Christmas, but I had no sense of ownership. I always felt like I felt very privileged to be covering it. I have to emphasize, regardless of who was president, you know, you can't, this is not about Republicans or Democrats. It's just about our own history. So, and I had a great sense of history. I mean, I do, but one of my favorite stories I did was for a column I used to write called The White House Letter, and I did a story once on all the presidential portraits that hang in the White House, and I had one of the curators take me around and show me each portrait. I mean, you can't, when you're running through covering news, you don't always notice them, and tell me a little story about each one, and that's really kind of moving when you see Washington's portrait and Lincoln's portrait and some of the lesser known ones, and realize how long this house has been around and how important it is in our history.
And is there a point at which they stop sort of checking you every single day when they know you and they just wave you on in?
No, never. No, you get a White House hard pass. You know, you have to apply for it, and you check. It takes months, and you get checked out by the Secret Service. They run a security check, and every time you go through the White House, even if you go through 10 times the Northwest Gate where the press goes in, 10 times a day, you have to you go through a metal detector, and you swipe your pass. You have to put in a special code that goes along with your pass, and then you go through the metal detector, and so does all your stuff.
It's not exactly just like home, anyway.
No, absolutely not.
Elizabeth View Miller is National Affairs Correspondent for The New York Times. She covered the White House from 2001 until 2006. Her article in the current National Geographic is called Inside the Presidency. Elizabeth, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending
the
hour.
Great question.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.